honest, in-the-moment feedback that helped me change my ways. It's entirely possible I am now living the final year of my life. I genuinely feel like the luckiest person on the planet.
Conversations. Radio people in their own words. Alone. Gary Burgess.
I grew up in the outskirts of Manchester, in the town of Bury, one of those very boring 2.4 children families in your classic two up, two down. My earliest memory is, curiously, of my newborn baby brother being in the pram in the back garden, mum in the kitchen looking on, and apparently the first naughty thing that I remember being scolded for was going into the back garden and projecting my brother out of his pram by grabbing the handle as far as I can and catapulting him across the lawn. I was one of those ridiculously studious pupils who kind of got it immediately, but didn't really try too hard. I was the first in the class to understand long division. I was the one helping the other students out with their fractions and observing what was going on around me, and I wonder whether that set me up as the sort of person I became. There was one teacher at school who effectively set me up for life in terms of media, who I've actually stayed in touch with over the years. Mrs. Anderton was an English teacher in my secondary school in Blackpool by this point, who was the very first teacher to set up the media studies class. And I was in that first cohort where Mrs. Anderton even set up a school radio station. She celebrated her 80th birthday a couple of years ago. And it was one of the privileges of my lifetime to be able to go back for that reunion and to really reflect on what a difference one person can make to another's life.
You are tuned to the English service of Radio RSA.
In 1982, we moved from Manchester to South Africa because of my dad's job at the time. And for me, my education was quite different because most of the students were born in South Africa. They could speak both English and Afrikaans. So their second language, the equivalent of learning French in England, was to learn Zulu. I can only remember Zawabana Tisha, which is good morning teacher. But my second language lesson was actually Afrikaans with Miss Ely. There were just three of us in the class where we had to learn Goeiemôre and Baie Dankie and Tot Ziens. We still used chalk and slate to write our lessons down on rather than exercise books in the early 80s. My friends had gone, the climate was different, the visual landscape was different. But in the background, this new constant was this box playing the radio. My first memory was that every morning the weather forecast ended with the temperature being 29 degrees. It was just always 29 degrees. I don't know whether that was true or not, but this consistency of hearing this message coming out of the radio. And then the first song I remember was actually a couple of years later. It was 1984, Queen and Radio Gaga. And it's a song that to this day transports me back to being this 8-year-old in South Africa, in the back garden, in the sunshine, listening to the radio, and suddenly all was well with the world. So from South Africa, we returned to England in 1985 and we moved to Blackpool, which is where my grandparents lived. And it's from there I went from primary school to secondary school. And it's really at that point that my love affair with radio was cemented. One of my earliest memories is laid there under the duvet in my bed with this bedside clock radio, this slightly dirty cream looking clock radio with its red digital clock display, but then the analog tuner. And at night, as you're tuning along the dial from this crackle, suddenly this voice came out of the ether, and it was Alan Bezek doing the late night phone-in on Red Rose Radio. I'd never heard anything like it in my life.
Hello, Laura.
I want to talk about hanging.
Go on then. Well, I think it shouldn't be brought back at all.
Why not?
Well, there's no reason for it to be brought back.
Yeah, there is. The crime figures are scandalously increasing.
Yeah, but it won't deter them.
Might deter some.
Well, why? Look at the Moors murders. Hanging was in then and it didn't deter them.
I didn't say it deterred them all, I said it deterred some.
At this point, my career plans were to be either an airline pilot, or a bank manager, or a lawyer. And then one day a friend told me, and this is one of those moments where someone tells you something, you don't question it, and you just accept it at face value. They said, if you've got eczema, you can't be an airline pilot. I was then going to be a banker or a lawyer. That was my plan. I was going to make my millions. But during the course of my high school years, we opened up a school radio station. And suddenly this captivation of listening to the radio became a bug of doing the radio. I went to school at 7 o'clock every morning to present 1 hour of golden oldies for the cleaners. It was played down the corridors and in every classroom. Then in my lunch hour every day, we turned it to a hot chart format, playing the biggest pop hits of the day. And then just before the afternoon lessons, we did a 10-minute news bulletin that went into the staff room. I was in school from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m, super serving different audiences with my own split service, and suddenly any idea of being a banker or a lawyer or indeed making my millions was out of the window. My parents were devastated that their son, who had these grand ambitions in life, was instead wanting to work on the radio. Indeed, the very early days of trying to make this point was me going in the middle of the night to be the tea boy helping out on the overnight show at the radio station that had just opened in Blackpool in 1992. That was Radio Wave. I was there from 1 in the morning till 7 in the morning, and then at 7 in the morning went straight to work at a call centre during the day. Radio Wave was the first commercial radio license to sit entirely inside the license of another commercial radio station. So it was a small footprint wholly inside Red Rose Radio in Lancashire. At the time, a lot of scepticism as to whether or not this thing could survive. And of course, in the decades that followed, commercial radio expanded in exactly that style. Radio Wave was based in the upstairs ceiling void of a party accessory showroom on an industrial estate on the outskirts of Blackpool. It overlooked the train line by Leighton Station. There was a Brickies over the road. There was a tile warehouse. It was as unshowbiz as you could get. However, when you went through the doors of reception and up the staircase, and there were some gold discs on the wall, and you went into the main office area and you saw the car stickers and all the promotional material for the radio station, from day one there was a real buzz of excitement in the air that people in Blackpool were wanting to create something for Blackpool. And indeed, Blackpool has aspirations of being as showbiz as Las Vegas. In reality, it isn't quite like that, but it's great to aspire to. But my word, it tried to spread the sparkle wherever it went, with its roadshows, with its presenter appearances, with its entirely unorthodox approach to the output of the radio station. It reacted to what the listeners wanted from day one and melded and changed and developed over time to truly reflect the quirks of Blackpool.
Good morning, this is Neil Sexton welcoming you live to the brand new sound of Radio Wave 96.5 on the Fylde Coast. The tide has turned.
I call you, I need you, my heart's on fire.
My first show on Radio Wave, well, first of all, my voice was about 28 octaves higher. I was, 17 years old at the time. I was nervous as hell. It was a time when about 75% of the music was on vinyl, about 25% was on CDs. The CD players had a knack of skipping. The jingles were played out of DCS, that was the playout system of the time. And there was me, this teenager, in the studio, on my own with this mixing desk that appeared to be bigger than I was, suddenly attached to the transmitter that was literally attached to the top of Blackpool Tower. It was exciting, but it was also terrifying. And of all the songs I could have started with, and the program controller said, you can pick any song in the world. You can have a free choice first song. And I still to this day have no idea why I chose Chicory Tip, Son of My Father. Mainly because I like the intro of the song.
Mama said to me, we got a happy life run.
Blackpool is a desperately poor town where there is this veneer of holiday golden mile kiss me quick candy floss excitement. Scratch behind that veneer, there is an awful lot of poverty, there are an awful lot of problems, and there still are to this day. At the time was no different back in the early 1990s, so the idea suddenly of this town having its own radio station by people from its own town, broadcast from its own town, talking about its own town, suddenly created a disproportionate amount of interest. Every taxi was playing Radio Wave. Even the buses and the trams were playing Radio Wave. The hotels, the guest houses. So I started as Radio Wave's, I guess, first T-boy back in 1992, the helper outer who would do literally anything. I remember earwigging one day, there was a last minute commercial needed making and there was no one to make it. I'd never edited in my life. And I said, I'll do it. Suddenly I was there with the Revox reel-to-reel machine, a China graph over my right ear, this razor blade in hand, this editing block with the 45 degrees and the 33 degree angles, whether it was music or speech or whatever. And then within a few years, a job came up working in the newsroom. So I suddenly developed this overnight interest in news and I practiced speaking a little bit deeper and I applied to be a journalist in the newsroom and actually got the job. It was my first time on the payroll. The job came with a very low salary. I think it was barely over £10,000, but it was bumped up by the inclusion of a company vehicle. I was very excited about this because the sales team and some of the presenters got to drive around in their flashy Radio Wave cars and this would be me. However, the phrase company vehicle was very intentionally written like that in my contract because they actually gave me the outside broadcast truck. This huge Renault van with the Yagi aerial and mast on the roof that was entirely impractical was suddenly my company car. The novelty of that wore off very quickly. I went back to getting the bus to work, but suddenly I was on the payroll. I got to do the news on my local radio station. And over the course of the following years, I moved back into programming, presenting the afternoon show and then the breakfast show. And within 9 years of joining the radio station, I was the program controller, suddenly in charge of the output of this wonderful radio station that still to this day means so much to me.
96.5 Radio Wave.
One of the biggest challenges of programming a radio station like Radio Wave, well, first of all, was the lack of resources. There just were no resources at any point. If you had an idea for something grand to do, you had to scale back those plans to find the version that could be done with no more than a budget of a fiver if you were lucky. There were also quite a lot of presenters who'd never done radio before, so it was the challenge of teaching them the basics. The upside of having no automation in those days was that you always needed overnight presenters to keep the needle moving and the transmitter warm. So that was an excellent training ground. Indeed, it's where I'd begun. But it was also a chance to think outside the box, to think, how can we do things differently? Well, why don't we just take our evening show out every night onto the Golden Mile and make it up as we go along and reflect the excitement of the illuminations? And suddenly, our our evening shows were called the Illumination Special, just one example of necessity being the mother of invention. It's also where I got to do things you would never expect to be able to do. I broadcast live from a zip wire, a rope strung from the top of Blackpool Tower, 517 feet high, going right down onto the promenade over the electric wires that powered the tramway. I remember having this radio mic gaffer taped to my hand so I wouldn't drop it. It probably wouldn't pass the risk assessment these days. But if you ever wanted 2 minutes of somebody screaming out loud in a force nine gale, well, that's exactly what we achieved that day. It's also where we did a lot to support the local community. For me, one abiding memory is at the time setting a world record for the longest breakfast show, 76 hours. I started at 6 o'clock on a Friday morning. I finished at 10 o'clock on the following Monday morning, and over the course of that weekend we raised tens of thousands of pounds towards a local cancer unit that was being built. Cracking radio. By the end of it, absolutely knackered, but it ticked all those boxes of engaging with the audience, of them caring about what you were doing, but also being able to make a difference in the community in a truly tangible way.
It's The Wave 96.5. This is Gary Burgess with Blackpool's biggest breakfast show. It's 10 o'clock, so that means 36. I'm in my 41st hour on air.
Oh, well done.
At which point, I should be absolutely knackered, and I feel really, really good.
If you're listening, in 2001, when the Wireless Group was the then owner of Radio Wave, I got the opportunity to move on to their other radio station based in Warrington. That was Wire FM, based in the old school building on the outskirts of town that Chris Evans used to go to school in. It was there I presented the afternoon show and programmed the radio station, and was my first chance to go into a radio station as the programmer. In the years gone by at Radio Wave, of course, for some, I was always the T-boy done good, but suddenly to go into this radio station at that, I guess, level of authority as I saw it at the time. Of course, I now know you're just a programmer. Get over yourself. But it was a really exciting moment for me to learn a new patch, a new TSA, to bring in the things I thought I knew. I was a terrible manager to begin with. I decided that to be a brilliant manager, you had to write lots of memos. And we are talking memos, not emails. Back in those days, I would proudly be typing away and putting more information in than was absolutely necessary, and making sure it was legally unambiguous, so it was really clear that when I said you had to say the name of the radio station at the start of every link, blah, 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 blah. Oh, for goodness sake, get over yourself, Burgess. I was not good. And it was actually a very kind colleague when I was covering a weekend show. It was a Saturday night, and a colleague came into the studio. I just bashed out another memo and put it in each of the boxes of the presenters. And this presenter said, "Can I just give you some feedback?" I said, "Yes, of course." Very, very cocksure and sitting a little bit taller because I was the best manager ever. And this presenter, I won't use the exact words they used, but it was a very blunt version of, "You're an idiot." And it burst my bubble, and I wanted to be horribly offended, and I wanted to be angry with them. And actually, even in that moment when I was shell-shocked, and certainly to this day I realised, it was one of the greatest kindnesses. This was someone who gave me honest, in-the-moment feedback that helped me change my ways and made me realise managing is, it's not about processes, it's about people.
Good evening, you're listening to The Academy on 107.2 Wire FM. Robbie Williams with Supreme, and just that song then, the amazing tune from a local band called The Bridge, who are joining me in the studio.
Wire FM
now
was the local radio station broadcasting to Warrington, Widnes and Runcorn. They are three towns that are geographically close, but that are culturally so different. You've got one part of the patch that looks more to Liverpool, another part of the patch that looks more to Manchester, and has very little in common day to day other than rugby league. So the key to Wire FM back in those days was just to dial up the rugby league as loud as you could make it, even in the music programming, just loving that there was going to be a match, making sure we got the first interview with the manager Yorkshire and so on and so on and so on, because the fabric of Warrington Widnes and Runcorn at the time was absolutely its rugby league passion. So that came through the radio station. But again, one of the recurring themes of every radio station, and Wire FM was no exception to me, was the absence of money to invest in programming. But at the time, it was a real frustration that investment was not there. These businesses were not overly flush with cash. And when they were part of groups, the group was not expending any more pennies than it absolutely needed to do. One of my early realizations was that your best friend in programming is your sponsorship and promotions manager. So we worked thick as thieves to try and create the best promotions. They didn't have to be the biggest promotions, but just promotions that would get people talking. Listeners are lovely. Listeners are our lifeblood. But there's a small minority of listeners who can be incredibly intense. I remember in the very early days of Radio Wave, because we were live through the night, you'd get your regulars, and it became quickly apparent to me how much you were a vital part of their lives, but also how much time that could take up with the daily and nightly phone calls, sharing the highs and the lows of their lives. But that also included listeners ringing up from phone boxes in the middle of the night in those days, talking about their own mental health problems, and even talking about ending their lives. These were not phone calls that made it to air. But actually, as an overnight presenter back in those days, you were also very much a social worker and counsellor, with a listener on one line whilst you were then dialing out on the other line to the police to try and get someone round to that particular phone box on that particular estate. Those moments were intense.
Playing your favourites, but a free Q96.
John Evington, the then group programme controller of the Wireless Group, called me out of the blue and said, Gary, tomorrow you need to get on a train to Glasgow. We have a problem in Glasgow. The Wireless Group at the time had a radio station called Q96 that was licensed to broadcast to Paisley and Renfrewshire. However, the programming team at the time had decided they'd turn it into this big Glasgow radio station and effectively forget or stop serving the TSA they were licensed to serve. Well, the then radio authority picked up on this. They were not happy. They issued a yellow card warning, which they didn't do too often. And my job was to get on the train, go to Glasgow, where the studios were based, so they weren't even based in their TSA, and effectively shut down and restart this radio station in 5 days. It's exactly what I did. At the time, they'd rebranded it as QFM. Well, I went straight to Paisley. I walked around town. I popped into all the shops, and I just asked, what's the name of the local radio station around here? And without exception, they said Q96. And I then said, oh, do you listen? And without exception, they said no. So I knew we had a problem. But I knew the brand was Q96. So we brought back the old name, contacted Charles Nove at Radio 2 to be the station voiceover for this warm Scottish reassuring sound, and then turned this radio station into a really local radio station that loved and cherished and shouted about its area. And 2 weeks later, the radio authority re-monitored the radio station, and they sent a letter saying, we have never heard such a speedy and dramatic transformation. We'd given back the local radio station to the area whose radio station it was. I was so proud of that. I'd just signed an 18-month lease on an apartment in the area. I'd fully invested, so my short train trip to Glasgow then became a, please can I stay and run this brilliant local radio station. And then about 6 months later, I got a phone call out of the blue from a radio station called Island FM in Guernsey in the Channel Islands, asking if I'd like to be the breakfast presenter and programme director. My first thought, which I didn't say out loud, was, where the heck is Guernsey? But before I knew it, I was on a plane flying into the Channel Islands, ready for the next chapter of my career. The way I describe the Channel Islands is mini France, but looking to Britain. So you've got a warmer climate, you've got place names and street names that have that French feel. There's that al fresco vibe. Everything's a bit more laid back. But then you've got all the cultural familiarities of the UK, for example, the brands of the shops and restaurants that you might expect, the flights to Gatwick and Manchester going every few hours. The pound is the currency of choice. English is, of course, the language. I found this sweet spot, and I continue to enjoy this geographical sweet spot of this British familiarity, but also this nod to France and the continent. It really is the best of both worlds. I knew I wanted to live there. Looking down, the sea was Caribbean blue. There were these glistening jewels across the island that I now know are the glass houses, but they were reflecting the gorgeous sunlight that day. I landed, I was picked up by the then managing director and driven to the radio station. It wasn't really a job interview, it was much more a 2 to 3 day guided tour of the island where they were doing a sell job to me. Well, I'd already fallen in love but hadn't said so and got to meet the team and meet the wonderful Island FM crew. And at the end of this weekend, I was driven back to the airport and he said to me, "We'd like to offer you the job. Obviously, you'll want to go away and think about it." And I said, no. "We've got 10 minutes between now and the airport. Let's just sort this out now. I would love to take this job," which was possibly my worst piece of negotiating because I'd played all my cards. But actually, by the time I got to the airport to fly back to Glasgow, I knew I was flying back to Glasgow to give notice on my job, on my apartment, because the next stop in my career was going to be Guernsey and Island FM. I inherited a radio station that had got quite hot. The presenters all thought everything had to be really cool. Everything had to be really hot jocking. And it sounded good, but I had a sense that here was a radio station that almost everyone in the island could listen to because of the very limited nature of the radio market. We were lucky there was just Island FM commercially and BBC Radio Guernsey as far as the BBC goes. Yes, there were the national radio stations, but they really didn't feature. And we needed to broaden the appeal of the radio station, just not by anything clever, just by calming it down. So there was no magic, no secret sauce, but just encouraging all the presenters to just calm it down and enjoy it more.
Guernsey, Summeray Park, Island FM and Wave Telecom, this is what you're here to see. Make the loudest noise of the night. Girls and lads, come on!
And I arrived as the new breakfast show presenter, so I arrived quite naive, not knowing much about the island, and rather than falling into the trap of thinking I knew everything and then making all these pronunciation errors on air, I was very honest from day one. I asked effectively the listener to be my tour guide. I'm new to this island, I'm new to this radio station, I want to be your friend, I'd love you to be my friend, come on, let's do this. And that very much filtered through the rest of the radio station. A real friend of a radio station, and the audience numbers just began to creep up bit by bit. I mean, it never did badly. We're talking 50% reach, for goodness sake. But within a couple of years, it was 52%, it was 55%.
Live from the Pleasure Rooms, 107.6, Juice FM.
So in late 2006, and I'd only been at Island FM for 3 years, I got a call from John Dash and Simon Walkington at UTV Radio, and we had conversations, and before I knew it, I was UTV Radio's senior programmer north. That basically meant day to day, I was the program controller of Juice FM, a dance radio station in Liverpool, whilst at the same time being the senior programmer overseeing the programming teams of UTV Radio's 8 North of England radio stations. So Wave in Blackpool, Wish Wire and Tower, Imagine, Pulse 1 and 2, and also the soon-to-be-opening Central Radio in Lancashire, which didn't live long in this world. It was a job with hindsight I don't think was ever destined to properly work out, that being day-to-day full-time responsibility of a dance radio station in a city, whilst at the same time, time overseeing these other radio stations that were much more in the sort of heart mould of radio at the time, that were very much rooted in their local communities. So it was a tough gig for those reasons. As senior programmer north for UTV Radio, I don't think I was that happy that often. There were lots of individual moments that I loved, primarily around people, whether it was working alongside John Dashton and Simon Walkington, or the programmers at the radio stations, or the presenters primarily at Juice FM in Liverpool that I saw most often. But I don't think I was happy, because I didn't feel that I was doing a good job for anybody else, and my frustration set in. And there were a few points where that even turned to resentment as well. And it was a really good life lesson for me, because I've always said to other people, you don't work in radio for the money. So if you're ever not enjoying the gig, get out of the gig. In January 2008, I left UTV Radio and returned to Guernsey in the Channel Islands. And I had no job to return to. That was quite a scary moment. It was the first time in my life that had been the case. But I had this such strong sense that I wanted to be back down in the islands. I was also longing to be back on air. I'd missed being behind that mic so much. So I contacted BBC Radio Guernsey and said, hi, you might remember me from years gone by. Well, within a few weeks, I was covering their afternoon show. And within a month, I'd been appointed their breakfast presenter, suddenly presenting 3 hours of pure speech radio every morning. A whole new chapter. Comparing BBC local radio in Guernsey to all my commercial radio experience was absolute chalk and cheese. It was a complete shock to the system. I was so used to the think it, do it approach to getting things done. Suddenly, if you had an idea for something that you thought might improve the output of the radio station, it was either that sort of stroke of the chin, we'll go away and consider it reaction from your manager that you just knew was code for not a cat in hell's chance, but I'll go away until you've forgotten about it. Or more commonly in my experience, we will set up a working group to consider this over the next 3 months. And so I quickly realised the best way to make change, and I'm sure no programmer will appreciate me saying this, was just to go on air and do it. So I did. From working in commercial radio newsrooms and doing those 3-minute bulletins on the hour with short clips, I was suddenly presenting this 3-hour all-speech breakfast show, and albeit on a small radio station in a small island, but this is an island with its own government, so effectively it is national radio for the island, and you are interviewing government ministers, the chief minister, effectively the prime minister, and opposition members of the parliament as well. It was a steep learning curve, but very interestingly, my forensic mind from my lawyerly mind from my school days suddenly came into its own like never before, and I developed a reputation for quite forensic, precise interviewing, where every word of every answer from that minister mattered, and I'd be listening to pick up on the nuance or the wiggle room in their answers. And this was something that hadn't really been done in the same way at the radio station. It wasn't quite what would you like to tell us, minister, but it certainly wasn't a culture of having a go, of holding them to account. And I felt that was my obligation as the breakfast presenter on this public service broadcaster, and my word, it made people sit up and take notice.
This is Channel Television, ITV in the Channel Islands.
On two occasions, a few years into my time at BBC Radio Guernsey, across the corridor in the same building was ITV Channel Television, and they'd said, oh, there's a job of a reporter coming up, are you interested? And on both occasions I'd said, No. And this is because, number one, my passion absolutely was radio. Number two, the immediacy of radio trumped television every time. The thought of working all day just to this 6 o'clock evening news programme, whereas on the radio, if something happens, we can just do it there and then. So the idea of that didn't appeal. But then on the third occasion, where they said, oh, there's a reporter job coming up here, would you be interested? There was just a niggle in my mind which said, you might regret it if you don't try it. And radio will probably still be there if it all goes wrong. So I went in for a screen test and for an interview, and suddenly I'd made the move from radio to TV. TV was a whole new world for me. It was daunting, a bit like radio does. It had its own internal language and jargon that I didn't understand. People were walking around talking about Ulays, Sots and Astons and Chirons. And in my early days, I was effectively creating radio reports with pictures painted over the top. And I sometimes see that on television, but it doesn't work. Good television is picture-led, and you use the voiceover sparingly, not to describe what the viewer is seeing, because the viewer can see it, but you use your voiceover to add context and understanding to those pictures. So I'd say it probably the first year or two was a big steep learning curve. But on the flip side, those skills that we perhaps take for granted in radio, to be able to talk without notice, to ad-lib our way out of problems so that people don't realise there's a problem, if a guest doesn't turn up, just jock your way through it. I was able to use that in my live reporting on the television as well. It's really apparent to me that radio, television, online outlets are increasingly becoming platform neutral, platform agnostic outlets. But it also highlights those that do it well and those that do it badly. And I think every medium can learn from the other medium. Video increases engagement. That is a statement of fact. But there is so much bad video doing the rounds from radio that frustrates me on a near daily basis. For a medium obsessed with good quality sound, we see such poor sound quality videos being published, but also with poor lighting as well. So for me, it's get the lighting and sound right. You don't need lots of expensive equipment to do that. And then it's just asking that basic question of, why are you doing this in the first place? I see radio stations squirting out content onto their Facebook and Insta and Twitter feeds like there's no tomorrow, but I'm not quite sure sometimes why they're doing it, other than perhaps it is the ego of the presenter involved. And I include myself, I've done those videos in my time as well. But those that get it right, that really consider how can this make an emotional connection with the person on the receiving end of it, that then has the effect of that person wanting to engage more with your brand, with your product, with your service. That's the magic. One of the things I learned for myself early on when I moved from radio to television was to treat the television camera in exactly the same way I treat the microphone in the radio studio. I've always treated the microphone in the studio as a good friend. So I'm always talking on a one-to-one basis. I also automatically know whether I need to add an explanation around a person or a subject. So I only need to say Boris Johnson. I don't necessarily need to say Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but I would currently need to say President-elect or President Joe Biden, because I'd think perhaps the cut-through isn't entirely there. And I found exactly the same with a TV camera, which is I need to make sure I'm talking to just one person when I'm talking down the barrel of the camera. And one of the stylistic things I developed early on, it wasn't a conscious thing, but was to make sure I wasn't always maintaining eye contact with the camera, because we don't stare at our friends all the time. it's quite a strange thing to do. So I'm very relaxed when I'm delivering my pieces to camera in a package, or when I'm delivering lives at 6 o'clock in the news, that I will just glance away quite naturally into the middle distance, because it's how we all talk to each other and it just feels much more natural. So I talk to the camera as a friend, but I also glance away from time to time just to make it feel like the most natural thing in the world.
And the story is here. I've heard so many anecdotes today of anti-Portuguese sentiment in Jersey, anti-Jersey sentiment in Jersey. The story of a Southeast Asian lady who lives
It's in really Jersey. Interesting how the big fish, small pond syndrome is alive and well in the Channel Islands, first in Guernsey and now in Jersey. Because there aren't many familiar public voices initially on the radio and faces on television, and you're broadcasting to a very small number of people, relatively speaking. You know, if you were starting from scratch, there probably wouldn't be an ITV region called Channel, but here we are, it's broadcasting to around 180,000 people. So that close connection with the audience is real, because you are there in that very small community. But you also do get noticed quickly. There are upsides and downsides to that. If you ever make a mistake, oh my word, you will be told in no uncertain terms. Actions have consequences, they say, and news stories have consequences when you live in a small community. There have been a number of occasions where I've sat in a courtroom to cover a court case, and then I've been on the news that evening, and suddenly relatives of said accused, who's now behind bars, are getting in touch with you, expressing in no uncertain terms their displeasure of your news coverage. Quite understandably, given their inevitable emotional state, misunderstanding that you are simply reporting facts and doing your job, but it's presented back to yourself as you've got it in for them, you're having a go, you're biased. And that's when it happens for the first time, can be very unsettling. I've had people get in touch via the newsroom, you know, threatening harm. Very, very rarely, but it has happened. And of course, these days, far more commonly with social media, it's so much easier for anyone to comment anytime on any story at any point, not least in recent months with coronavirus. The number of people are accusing me of scaremongering for simply reporting the day's news and events as well. So it's something I'm very aware of, but it's also something I keep in check, because you have to remind yourself you're talking about the exception rather than the rule. You know, I remind myself 179,000 people didn't have a go at me today, but that handful that I see on my Twitter timeline or sliding into my direct messages, you just have to be careful not to lose perspective about it.
This is Gary Burgess. It's Sunday morning. It means it's the happiest show of the week show. A whole stack of feel-good tunes as always.
In recent months, I got an opportunity to get back into doing radio. I didn't hesitate to say yes. In fact, I think I'd said yes before the question had finished being asked. Channel 103 in Jersey were looking for someone to cover their breakfast show for a few weeks. And having done breakfast shows over the years, I know how much fun they could be. But then they were looking for someone to do a regular weekly show at the weekend that would just create a little bit of a point of difference. We don't hear too much on radio of appointments to listen, but a Sunday morning show we created that's ended up, like many things in radio, a happy accident, that it's now called the Happiest Show of the Week show. Over the years, at various points, I've been quite unwell. Back in 1999, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer and had a tumour removed, but the cancer had spread, so I had chemotherapy. But then all was well with the world. Then around 5 years ago, some tumours returned to my lungs and they could be surgically removed. All was well with the world. And then in around 2017, I suddenly became very quickly very unwell. I was barely able to function. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't see straight. All my mojo had been removed almost immediately. I went to the doctor expecting on this Thursday morning to be signed off for Thursday and Friday. And the doctor said, I'm signing you off initially for a month. Well, that month turned into a year and a half. And it, in the end, actually took 286 days to find a diagnosis. I had every test and prod and poke and investigation under the sun. And I was diagnosed with myalgic encephalomyelitis, also thankfully more easily known as ME, which is a variant of a chronic fatigue syndrome. There was an evening when I went to the bathroom to brush my teeth, and I held up a toothbrush and I held up another toothbrush. I knew one was mine and I knew one was my husband's, and I just didn't know which was which. I did not have the processing capacity to know which toothbrush was mine. That's how much it can steal from you. I walked like this pathetic child into the lounge, holding up two toothbrushes, quite tearful, going, which is mine? And then brushing my teeth and going to bed. And I'd be in bed for days at a time. Some days I would have no more energy than be able to go to the bathroom and do my ablutions and go back to bed. And as a consequence, given how much, and I think for many people working in radio or media, how much your job, your vocation, your passion is part of who you are, to have that work stripped away as well effectively gave me too much thinking time, because all I could do was lie there and think. And so that, for the first time in my life, was also where I experienced what I guess people would call depression, or a depression, how that felt, having suicidal thoughts. They were never so serious that I thought I was going to end my life, but I did have suicidal thoughts about how I might end my life. A very dark time in my life, and one where that inner reserve of resilience was used like never before. Every last drop was needed to get me through that time. So about a year and a half after developing these symptoms, I was finding a way to manage my energy more often than not. And I felt I was able to work maybe one day a week, maybe 2 days a week. And so I began back at ITV News doing a couple of shifts a week. It was a joy to be back because I was getting me back. I was back doing the job I loved. And over time, those two shifts eventually became three shifts, and that was my limit. In between times, the offer from Channel 103 to do some radio came along. And again, if I did the radio instead of the television, I could manage 5 4-hours across a week. In effect, show and go. As long as I literally did the show and no more, I could manage that as well. And as things stand today, I'm in much better shape with my ME, but unfortunately in recent months my cancer came back in November 2019 and I had to undergo what's called salvage chemotherapy. In effect, last chance saloon chemotherapy. It spread all around the area between my heart and lungs. It was a grueling 3 months of chemotherapy, hair falling out, projectile vomiting.
He's been missing from our TV screens for the past few months, but today marks an important day for our colleague Gary Burgess. Since November, he's been having chemotherapy in Southampton for a relapse of his testicular cancer.
Today is the last day.
The wonderful news was, after 3 months of this chemo in hospital, the tumours had either gone or had shrunk. I was able to get back to my work just at the start of the pandemic, so got into the journalism of the story of my lifetime. And then a matter of months later, I had a scan that had showed the tumours had come back, blood work to show the tumours had come back, and the situation was as bad as it could be. In November 2020, the oncologist breaking the news to me that there was no treatment left and that I had 6 to 12 months to live. I knew bad news was coming. The journalist in me, every step of the way, has done an awful lot of research. I don't play Dr. Google. I go and find the original research source notes of the illness or the medication or the treatment regime. I had a sense that the scan was going to show the return of the cancer, but I also knew that if that was the case, the options were either limited or non-existent. So in my mind, it was 18 months to 2 years that I thought I was going to be told I had to live. But nothing, and I do mean nothing, prepares you for that moment where the oncologist, who in normal times would be sitting face to face with you, but because of this pandemic was on a video call on my iPhone, was breaking the news to you that the cancer was back, that there wasn't a treatment available, and that it's entirely possible I am now living the final year of my life. Receiving that news is followed by this strange emptiness, this silence. My husband, Alan, and I sitting on the settee, well, collapsing into each other's arms, crying our hearts out, that whole body shaking cry like you've never cried before. And then very quickly, you realise there are practical things you have to do. In normal times, you would be seeing your nearest and dearest face to face to share this terrible news with them. In COVID times, it's phone calls and FaceTimes and WhatsApp calls and video calls, starting with my dad. It is the cruelest call you can make, to have to ring your dad to break the news to your dad that his son may be dead in the next 6 to 12 months, is one of the cruelest things I've done in my life. It's the only time I've heard my dad cry. It is one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And it really brought home to me how cruel this past year has been for so many people. A story that I'd been reporting on as a journalist and tried to show empathy, suddenly I had this understanding beyond imagination as to the real life, real time consequences. I was very clear from the start that I didn't want the return of my cancer, my 6 to 12 months to live diagnosis, to be the elephant in the room. I was very keen to talk about it, so I shared it with my friends. I wrote a blog post that got shared all over the place, and quite overwhelming to deal with all of a sudden. These thousands, and I do mean thousands, of messages from friends and strangers near and far. But I was really keen to share my story for selfish reasons, because it helps me, but also because you hear a lot about someone's got cancer and they're having chemo and the story is get well soon, or someone's had cancer and they've died and the story is, oh, weren't they a lovely person? I've been gifted the opportunity to tell this story of what happens in the final months, because I think there is still this taboo around death. And so I wanted to make it as easy for my friends and family and other people as well to talk to me about it. But also very quickly to make them realise that life has to go on. I was being dispensed lots of advice from friends and strangers about what living my best life would be. And indeed, it was the same advice that I would previously have given to other people. It was quit your job, get off social media, go on endless holidays around the world. Well, the pandemic, of course, has put pay to that for now. But also, I very quickly realised that isn't living my best life. My best life is all the things I love. It's my friends. It's my family. It's doing the news on the telly. It's doing radio shows. It's also the mundane of life. So living my best life is doing all the things I love, and also very quickly trying to normalise my situation. And it might be that that 6 to 12 months diagnosis is 13 months or 2 years. I'm also acutely aware it might be 5 months or fewer. But my point remains, I don't want to spend every day moping. I've been gifted the opportunity, indeed the obligation, to spend every day truly living in the most wonderful, full-colour way I can. And that includes all the ordinary stuff. If you can't think of the right thing to say, get in touch and tell me you can't think of the right thing to say, because that is the right thing to say and is the start of the ability to have that conversation.
Hi Gary, it's Chesney Hawkes here. Wishing you and your lovely husband, Alan, a very Merry Christmas from me here in Los Angeles to you guys in the Channel Islands.
I have never known a reaction to something like the reaction to the news of my health. Utterly overwhelming. We think the age of the handwritten letter is over. Oh, no, it's not. They've come in from right across the Channel Islands from people I will never know and never get to meet. Words of wisdom, words of love, words of kindness. It's also been really interesting when I've been presenting the programmes on Channel 103, how the messages, the tone of those messages have changed. Even if someone's just getting in touch for a birthday mention for little Billy, the message always starts with this really personal preface, wishing me well, sending their best, and more often than not now, also mentioning Alan, my husband, as well. It is so personal. It means the world to me, and it is also a reminder of the really intimate connection that exists, not just in a small community like the Channel Islands, but among a radio station's audience and the people that they're listening to when they feel like they know that person, that they've got a stake in their story as well. It is not anything I intended. An interview was broadcast by ITV News sharing my story and how I was doing. And that night, suddenly friends started getting in touch saying, have you seen the fundraising page that's been set up? And I was like, what? And I looked online and this crowdfunding site had been set up to pay for a cruise for Alan and me. Because I'd said in the interview, one of the things on my bucket list is we want one last cruise together. We love going away on our cruise holidays. It was an incredible kindness, but obviously a kindness we could not accept. Number one, because we are in the very lucky position to not need someone to raise money for that cruise. But two, it just didn't sit comfortably with me. The kindness did, but it felt like the gesture could be put to better purpose. So I contacted the person behind it and said, obviously, thank you so much, but is there any way we could use this to raise money for Macmillan here in Jersey? So it very quickly got changed, and I wondered, would people still want to fundraise if it wasn't directly for an individual or a couple, but it was inspired by their story instead? Well, that night it got to £10,000, and the next day it got to £15,000, and as we talk now, just a few weeks later, it's at £32,000. This is an island of barely 100,000 people making donations for this cancer charity. That is just extraordinary. And then the knock-on effect of that, an ITV News viewer found out that I'd said I wanted that fundraiser to benefit Macmillan. So they went about contacting local businesses and collecting a whole variety of treats for Alan and me. It was presented to me just before Christmas. My dear friend Jess pulled up in a car alongside me at a distance, keeping our social distance. And she said, I've got a few presents for you. And I was like, well, great, I've got a Christmas present for you as well. And she's like, oh, no. You need to clear your seats of your car. And in came all these boxes of gifts and vouchers, champagne, an overnight stay in a hotel, meals, chocolates. I mean, gifts beyond imagination, including a local charter company offering up a cruise in local waters for Alan and me and some friends. It is the first time in my life where being absolutely overwhelmed became a physical feeling. It really was too much to process in the moment. It was physically difficult to accept this level of kindness from a stranger.
People just want you and Alan to have something special. So lots of different companies have donated what they can.
The video Jess recorded at the time shows me blubbing like you would not believe, because it's still, even now, for someone who uses words for a living, it is still difficult to put into words the kindness of strangers
The new rules on gatherings announced late this afternoon will not apply on Christmas Day. Well, Gary Burgess is live outside Jersey's hospital. Gary, clearly the government is worried.
A real change in the tone and the words in their messaging, which you'll hear in just a moment. So today's case statistics, as James mentioned, a huge one day's coming.
I genuinely feel like the luckiest person on the planet. I've been gifted this awful news about my own health, but I've been gifted such clarity about the road ahead. I may have just celebrated my last Christmas. I may have just celebrated my last birthday. It's our wedding anniversary at the end of March. Hopefully I'll make it to March. It may be my last wedding anniversary. And these are things that I break down and cry about a lot. But they're also moments of clarity, truly living life well. I get to sit behind the microphone in a radio studio and play these songs. And what I say is attached to a transmitter, and there are people listening on the other end. That is magical. That feeling from back on the 9th of August 1993 is suddenly back every time for me. I'm filled with hope. I'm filled with a strange sense of purpose to do something good. I don't quite know what that means. It's clearly all tied up with the idea of legacy. And I mean good in the dictionary sense of good. Someone who did good, but also somebody who made a difference. That can be making a difference to my nearest and dearest, making a difference, hopefully in some way, with current and former colleagues in radio and TV over the years as well. If people can look back over my life, and indeed in my dying days, if I can look back over my life and think, do you know what, Burgess? On reflection, you were a good person and you made a difference. I'll take that.